You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 320, Anarchy in the UK. What would happen if we just decided we didn't want politicians anymore? Could we survive in a world without Mr. Trump and Mrs. May? Well, we could try. We look at the consequences when sport is taken too seriously, and music wars, and a punch-up between punk and Britpop. Who wins? Ho-ho. That's all coming right up after The Silver Seas and What's the Drawback?
She's quite pretty, she plays the guitar, she's got the talent, but she doesn't want to be a star. Content to listen to the radio, she likes the magic chords in the EO.
Mystery in life, why the Silver Seas aren't one of the biggest selling names in music the world over, from the outstanding album Chateau Revenge in 2010. That is the Silver Seas. And what's the drawback? Welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. This is episode 320. I'm Terence Stackham, and she's no drawback. She's Juliet Harris.
I'm a throwback, more like. Hello, good evening, afternoon, morning, night. Hello, everyone. Hope you're well.
Jules, some may feel I'm making an unfair comparison when I put Donald Trump and Theresa May into the same envelope.
I don't feel you're being particularly unfair to me.
Felt that might be your view too, particularly after another excruciating week of misjudgment from the American president. But my reason for pitching them together is that I believe we would be better off and have more stable countries if their form of government was ended. And I'm serious about this. I'll explain. Mr. Trump, currently on his vacation. Mrs. May and all of her UK parliamentary colleagues are enjoying their absurdly long summer recess. And yet, despite that, the world carries on revolving. So here's my idea. Abolish, for the UK, abolish the House of Commons, House of Lords. We don't need these often rather pompous, self-regarding people making up puffed up laws and regulations. Most people...
Well, what about the Dangerous Dogs Act, Terence? Where would
now,
we be without
exactly,
that?
Exactly. You're proving my point for me, because most people...
Well, I hope you get attacked by a dangerous dog, Terence. That's all I can say.
Most people don't care about the so-called big stuff. Whichever party is in power, whoever is Prime Minister... Most people just carry on. You still have to go to the supermarket. People are more concerned about will they have a decent cob loaf or bloomer left in Waitrose rather than the second hearing.
This is assuming that everyone can afford to shop in Waitrose,
or,
which is a bit political.
Or Aldi or Lidl. You choose wherever you want to go and get your bloomer.
Have I ever told you, by the way, that my mum and her friend, who's quite middle class, insist on pronouncing it Lidl?
Oh, do they really?
They won't tell Lidl. People they've gone to Lidl's. They're in Lidl's. Buying bloomers, I suspect.
That's what people care about. They're not interested in the second hearing of the green paper on industrial flooring in oil refineries. People care about the electricity bill, the price of petrol, the weather next weekend when they go away for a couple of days. They don't care about what politicians think they should care about. Let's elect people to make decisions about the small stuff. They don't need to be paid, and I'm suggesting they just meet quarterly, say for a couple of days, and then they make their decisions, go back to their proper jobs, like village elders. And now, you're with me on this, Jules, I'm certain of it.
Well, there are a number of issues with this. I do agree with some aspects of what you say, and I do think that the Houses of Commons and Lords, I think the process is absolutely ridiculous. I think there are so many ways in which it could be modernised. I mean, the outcry which some people in it gave the news that the Speaker, Burke, who I think is excellent, by the way, took the very sensible decision to permit people not to wear ties in the House of Commons. And there was a lot of kind of fury from the usual suspects about this. And the reason for that being brought into place is that there's the young man that's been elected in Sheffield for Labour, who took Nick Clegg's seat in Sheffield Hallam. His name's Jared. I can't remember his surname. Yeah. He has a sort of cerebral palsy, which means that he really struggles doing shirt buttons up and can't, basically. So he wears a suit and a dark T-shirt, usually. And Burko brought that rule in to allow him to do so. And I think ridiculous. Yes, great. I completely agree with that. It's ridiculous. You have to bring a rule in the first place. And that is how unwieldy the House of Commons and the House of Lords are. So I do completely agree that, you know, all this mace-swinging, robe-wearing, you know, lip-smacking...
Black rod and all of this.
All this kind of, all that kind of rubbish. You know, I think that's all a load of old bull, basically. So yeah, I completely agree with that. I suppose really my kind of thoughts on your thoughts, and I used to work with a lady, she sort of worked out of our office, a very nice lady who'd been a Quaker for some years.
I went
out with someone that had a lot of sympathy with the Quakers for a while, and it's a shame she didn't adopt that kind of peace-loving nature into her personal life, shall we say, rather pointedly. But anyway, I've always had some sympathy with the Quakers as well. And so I spoke to this lady, Jo, about sort of what the Quakers were like, and she said... I said, is it that you all sort of sit in a room and no one leads it and you know, you all take it in turns to talk when you're so minded to do so? And she said, yes, it's true. And then she paused and went, it's often the same people that talk for a while and there aren't leaders, but there are leaders. And my view on this is... If you get sort of, it's just, you know, a few people that are unpaid and, you know, and they can decide stuff between themselves... If they're making decisions on behalf of other people, to what extent do we have a say in the decisions that they make for us?
These people I'm talking about, they're elected.
Yeah, but my concern is, if the constituencies are bigger than you say they are...
Yeah, I'd halve them at least, halve the number.
Yeah, to what extent does someone that, for example, say... I don't know, I'm trying to work the geography out, but... I worry that localised issues. So does local government continue in this utopian scenario?
I'd scale it down in the same way. And
in which case, then, who makes decisions about things? Well, what happens about things like bin collections? What happens about things like keeping up the general environment? If you say that people don't care about things, people don't care about things all the time they're working. When they're not working, people care about them very much.
Yes, but the two things on this. First of all, the way things work at the moment, we think, oh, I've got a local MP, I can go to him or her without my problem. Hmm. If you do go to a constituency surgery, it's very possible you won't see the MP, you'll see one of their aides who will take up your problem for you. If you do see the MP, the minute that you walk out, they hand over that blue folder with the notes of your case on it to one of their aides, and they do it anyway. So it's only a notional thing that the MP actually helps.
There are some MPs that are very good at casework, and there are some MPs that are very lazy and very bad at casework. And I suppose my argument to this is maybe there should be slightly less constituencies, but I think that we probably won't agree on this, but this is going to be one of those weeks where we don't agree on anything. I can just sense it. But whilst remaining very fond of each other at all times. I think that you are conflating the aspects in which make our democracy unwieldy, in which it doesn't always function terribly well. So a lack of accountability in our democracy with making it wildly more unaccountable.
Well, let me just put this other bit to you as well, because you said, how would it work locally? Now, I actually have first-hand experience of this, because I was an actual parish councillor in my village.
Parish councillor, that's a very small scale.
It's local, you said local, this was up to the last election, so I've got recent first-hand experience. Yep. But my point about this doesn't really matter how hyper-local it was, but my point is this. I remember the local MP talking to me and telling me that he felt we had more decision-making powers at a local parish level than he would ever have, because most MPs, and he included himself, are just lobby fodder. Whereas local representatives, like I was until the last election, make real decisions about funding locally, about bin collections that you mentioned, local planning.
You say local funding, but where does that local funding come from? Central government?
It's a combination of central government and the local taxes that you pay into your council tax.
Fair enough. The council tax point is valid, but I still think that a lot of funding comes from
central
government.
Some of it comes from central government, indeed. Yeah. But it's you also have this percentage raked off from the council tax that goes to your parish council.
True. And I do see that point. But having said that, in which case, I do think we do have the right system of government, in that we do have local, but perhaps we need to rebalance aspects of local decision making and put power back into the hands of local government. There was talk of this localism bill, which hasn't really kind of gone anywhere very much. From my professional perspective, we were expecting the community infrastructure levy to do big things, and it kind of hasn't really, because it's been sort of kicked into the long grass. I'd like to see local government have more powers. It was smashed apart by Thatcher in the 80s, and so it would be nice to see that kind of restored. And I like the idea of these kind of these urban mayors that we've got going on. So Andy Burnham, there was a very interesting piece in the Manchester Evening News by Jen Williams, who's their political editor person, who's excellent. She's a good Twitter follow, actually. And she did a review of what Andy Burnham's first 100 days were in power and what he'd achieved and some of the promises he were. And she really went into detail on things. And it was really... And in the meantime, when localism goes wrong, we see a story in the newspaper today saying that Boris Johnson's vanity project...
Oh. Oh my God,
as mayor of London have cost us £946 million.
Just shy of a billion. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, for no discernible end result. So not always local politicians are the answer. I think there are drawbacks. And I think this is where... And I think there's an interesting argument to be had inside this slightly spurious argument about whether to what extent democracy functions and how long should terms be. I mean, put it this way. In terms of accountability, why has this come out now that Boris is, 2 years out, a year or two out of office, really? It's maddening. So I do think our politicians need to be far more accountable than they are at the present. And I do think there needs to be a better balance. The reason why I think there needs to be a balance between local and national is do you know, I elect people to make decisions for me, Terence, and this is why I've been driven mad by these bleeding referenda, to give it the correct term. Exactly. And also, Jeremy Corbyn's Let's Ask the Labour Party what I should ask at parliamentary questions. Mate, you're getting a salary of six figures for this. You've got to sit down and work it out. And I'm on my lunch break. I can tell you to ask about housing, but you should know that already. So, actually, I think that I do elect politicians to make big decisions for me. I think there does need to be a layer of big decision makers above local government. And I was having a conversation with someone about this at breakfast the other day, and we both had the very unfashionable view that politicians ought to be paid more, and by more we mean a lot more. He was saying sort of $250,000.
Good God.
On the basis that then takes away any need for politicians to have second jobs or to be lobbied, particularly because if you have enough money, you sort of float above it, don't you, to some extent. I don't quite agree with his figure, but I can see the point he is making, which is it then removes politicians from the argy-bargy and the, oh, let's have dinner with these oil people and that kind of thing, and it frees them up to make big decisions. Because I think it is perfectly right, if you've got politicians deciding whether or not to bomb Syria, which I think is a decision that has to be made by people that are, when I say trained to do so, I know that the problem is there are lots of politicians that have come, it's a swing and a roundabout, in that you get people that come from other walks of life, which is great, but then it means that they're having to make sort of very big decisions. But my view is that actually I think it's perfectly reasonable that someone should make those decisions for a full-time job, and they should be paid properly to do that.
Just quick last couple of points from me on this is that the thing about money, paying them $250,000, then I think all that would happen then is you would get into the sort of Diego Costa situation.
Yeah,
that
fair enough
is never enough, you know.
I see the point of paying them, because then you don't, that's how
they won't need to be, won't need to,
the expenses scandal burst open. Absolutely. As well, let's be honest.
But also the fact where I'm sort of halfway in agreement with you is the fact that Boris Johnson is currently Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom. And that reflects the problem, because how on earth can... I mean, it just shows the corruption of our system, in that
it reflects on him very badly personally.
Of course it does. He was responsible for commissioning these buses that overheat all over London and are barely usable and they've got no air conditioning.
And the
bridge, that idiotic, imbecilic.
And also, let's not forget, as Theresa May put it in her Hustings speech to her MPs in those golden days when everyone thought she was the future, nearly new water cannons.
Yes, indeed, these water
cannons. Which Sadiq can't find anyone to buy them at the moment. The plan is to be sold off, and all of the monies go to funding charities against youth violence, which is magnificent.
But, the cannons could trail around behind the buses, because then as they overheat, could spray... cooling water.
Because we can broker practical solutions to self-made crises.
Football is wonderful. It stirs our emotions.
This is a controversy. Now, you're just one controversial statement after another, aren't you, Terence Farage?
Football sends us on stratospheric highs and harrowing lows. But is it possible to take the emotion?
Meanwhile, in Syria,
is it possible to take the emotional side of sport too seriously? We're looking at that next, after the splendid voice of Sharon Van Etten.
There were your eyes in the dark of the room, the only one shining, the only set I had met in years. It's not because I always look down, it might be I always look out. Speaking to me, I loosen my
Spend most of my life in perpetual confusion about this woman's surname. I keep thinking it's Sharon Von Etten, but it is in fact Sharon Van Etten, and yes. I just love that. I think that's so heartfelt. I've always disliked slow songs or ballads, but actually I very, very much enjoy that. She is a singer from New Jersey and Brooklyn in New York, and she's had various albums, and that tune Give Out came from Tramp, which was came out in 2012 under Jaguar, and was sort of the album that sort of broke her big, really.
She comes from Clinton, New Jersey. I went out with a girl from Clinton, New Jersey, who gave me a T-shirt with Clinton, New Jersey.
Excellent.
And then when I went around wearing it, everybody thought I was supporting the President of the United States. That's now in a wardrobe.
In a drawer somewhere, yes. And I believe that Clinton, part of Corner Shop, went on to reinvent themselves as Clinton, and I wonder if they were named after the place.
Oh, yeah, okay. Also, Sharon Van Etten now acting in the Netflix TV drama series The OA, so clearly...
Indeed, and she was also in Strange Weather as well, according to the wikis. A woman of many talents.
Many talents. The drama inherent in sport produces emotions that run through the whole range of our souls. It's been so from the chariot races in ancient Rome, through medieval jousting, to our modern era of competition. Whether you follow cricket, rugby, hurling, baseball, or especially football, your heart can soar or be broken by your passion, your alliance with your team.
Now a good time to tell the story of when I went to the World Snooker Championships and we were all sat watching Ronnie O'Sullivan, as it turned out, make a 146 instead of a 147. Yes. And it was so tense that a lady that I had never met before gripped my knee halfway through and then apologised afterwards.
Well,
we were very emotional. She seemed very nice. Her husband seemed a bit cross, but it was a real moment. We all lived that moment together, and we'd never met.
Well, it could have been the start of a great relationship, but for the fact that she had that husband next to her.
If you're out there, knee grippy lady,
But we need to ask if the media might push the connection of sport with conflict just a little too readily. This week, we learned that Neil Lennon, the manager of Hibernian in Scotland, is once again receiving death threats, this time after his Hibs side beat Rangers in a football match. Indeed, a 54-year-old man has been arrested on making such threats to Lennon. Mm-hmm. Now, last Saturday, I was at Stamford Bridge to find Chelsea 3-0 down at half-time to a robust Burnley side. Gary Cahill had been sent off for Chelsea, and the majority of the crowd, Chelsea supporters, were looking for somebody to blame as we collapsed to 3-0 down. So, of course, the referee was the handy target. And all of the defensive woes that led to us conceding three goals were blamed on the referee, Craig Pawson. Now, the whole stadium reverberated to boos and anger. And all around me, men... excuse me, it's always men, of course.
You didn't even have to qualify.
I didn't need
that,
to qualify. No, they were jumping up every time Pawson gave Burnley a decision, and they were literally foaming at the mouth, calling him every obscene name could ever imagine. And by the way, rather worryingly, the same sort of foaming and fanatical anger we saw on TV from Charlottesville this week. It kind of struck a chord at me. The looks on the faces of all the men were very similar. Maybe some of it is pantomime, but death threats and abuse certainly are not. And I felt monumentally glad that I didn't choose football refereeing as a career choice.
Yes. Almost as bad as being a football manager, I think. There's little to choose between either, as we've talked about previously.
I know. By the way, I checked the annual salary of a Premier League football referee.
Oh,
it's
yes.
between 50 to 70 grand a year. I mean, many players are on four times that a week.
Yes, absolutely.
how have we got to this, Jules? Does blame lie with the media for whipping up the tension at sports matches and in football in particular?
To some extent, I think. Although having, and of course, usually we would say, well, of course, social media and 24-hour media now make it even worse. But actually, yes, I think there is often an ugly side to sports. I think that sport is, I mean, this is going to sound very etymological, but sort of years ago, there was going to the football was very much the kind of the sort of thing that you did. And I was reading that article about Huddersfield recently, and it sort of quoted the, I can't remember who wrote it now, the going to the match. I think it wasn't, it might have been Stanley Spencer or someone like that. But it used to be a kind of, you know, working class men, mostly men, and people that worked in factories would go and watch football, and that was their release at weekends. And of course, you know, the parts of football have changed now, but I still think it is a very working class sort of audience that go and watch it. So I think often there is a lot of pent up frustration that comes out at a football match. I found myself being furious at a football match once because I had lost my job the week before, and I was just this ball of rage, as you know, as Hastings slumped to another pathetic defeat in the doesn't matter very much league or whatever it was then. But actually, I think that these kind of dreadful incidents, although there aren't that many, to be fair, and I think the fact that we have, you know, examples to talk about that are particularly extreme examples, I don't think there are that. I don't think it's that often. I'm going to use a particularly extreme example here because this predates both social media easily and also 24-hour rolling news, I would say, and the internet as well. This comes from 1994. So there's a second round match of the 1994 World Cup in the United States, which is United States versus Colombia. There's a chap that's playing in defence called Andres Escobar.
Yes.
He tries to cut out a pass from the American midfielder John Harkes. He mistimes his slide and stretches and inadvertently boots the ball into his own net. The US win the game 2-1 and Colombia are at the World Cup. So after the World Cup, you know, after they leave, Escobar decides he's going to go back to Colombia. He was going to visit relatives in Vegas but went back. So 1st of July, 5 days after they've been knocked out of the World Cup, he meets his friends and they go out and they go to a liquor store and they go to a nightclub. So obviously drink has been taken. He ends up in a car park by himself at 3 o'clock in the morning. Who hasn't been there in their life? And three men appear and start arguing with him. Two of them take out guns. Escobar is shot 6 times with a .38 caliber pistol, and it's reported that the killer shouted "goal" after every shot once for each time the South American football commentator said it during the broadcast. They then drive away in a pickup truck and left him, I'm afraid to say, to bleed to death. He died 45 minutes later, and everything suggested that he was murdered because of the own goal, and his funeral was attended by more than 120,000 people, apparently, which in a way is quite warming in a way. And apparently the chap that was arrested for it eventually is a bodyguard for members of inevitably a drug cartel in Colombia. Apparently someone had bet quite a lot of money on the match, apparently, and Escobar's own goal rather spoiled things. And so I think that is the ultimate example of things being taken too seriously, although I can actually give us a slight laugh out of this in a kind of a oh my god type way. And this is the BBC has been blessed. The BBC, we talk about the BBC being scared of its own shadow. Now, it has been fouling things up for years, to be fair, or rather has employed people that have been fouling things up for years. It had to issue a public apology after the football pundit Alan Hansen commented during the Argentina and Romania match that the Argentine defender warrants shooting for a mistake like that the day after the murder of Escobar. Yes, well done, Alan, again. So yes, I agree. I do think that, you know, the pent-up emotion, there's a real ugly side to football supporters sometimes. I don't, unfortunately, think that it is easy enough to blame social media or the media or, you know, the internet or whatever, because terrible things like this, you know, predate that, really. I mean, I suppose, you know, the phrase "it is only a game," it is easy to forget that, I think, when you're in the middle of it all. But I certainly think, having said that, though, there have been some things. For example, the Hillsborough disaster up in Liverpool. Liverpool and Everton fans have often united and done really moving kind of sort of gestures, I think, of holding banners of each other's teams. And also the Munich Air disaster. There was the, I know we've moaned a bit about dual scarves before and that kind of thing, but I thought that the sentiment behind them for the Manchester derby on the anniversary of the Munich Air disaster was really special, I think. So I don't think it's all bad, but yes, there are times where it goes too far, but I think that rather uncomfortably we can blame the human instinct for that rather than just the media by itself.
I think you're right. I don't think we can blame the media. I think we have a problem where men can't make the difference, can't define the separation between sport, which ultimately is just a game and doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter. And the issues in life that should enrage us, social injustice, racism, exploitation of power, inequality for women. And by the way, all the men going bananas towards the referee last Saturday, they weren't youngsters. They looked to me like they were in their 30s and 40s. And I think we have a real problem with these men who react with... They're the same men, I think, who react with similar fury if they perceive someone has gained 5 yards on them in a traffic line.
Absolutely.
Or looks at them in the wrong way in a pub.
Yes, and they're also the same men, I think, that are needlessly preventing gay footballers from coming out.
Indeed.
As we've talked about on the podcast previously, it's fragile masculinity, isn't it?
It is. And I see this, and it's not addressed at football. It's pretended that it is. But I go to Chelsea fairly regularly, and I've said before, beware any footballer who comes out with bleached hair or looks a bit unusual. He will receive taunts and shouts about his, you know, perceived sexuality, and the stewards stand there and do nothing.
Absolutely, I agree.
I mean, I don't have an answer on this. I don't know what stops it.
I don't know what the answer is. I think it's part of a wider social problem. And again, without sounding too patronising about it, I think this goes back to problems in you know, working class culture and social mobility or increasing lack thereof, and Brexit and all of these problems that seem to exist in a big meld in Britain now, worldwide with Trump as well in America, but particularly in Britain. And there doesn't seem to be any politician at the moment that has any level of foresight to be able to go back to your point earlier. There aren't any clear thinkers at the moment that have the courage to stand up and try and address things in a new way without using old solutions for the past, which are completely inadequate for the new challenges. You know, automation, these issues are only going to get worse, I think, rather than better. And actually, interestingly, and you know, this is the awful bit where I come out as a reluctant Blairite. I look forward to being tarred and feathered by my comrades in a few days' time. But I remember a friend of mine who I would say was roughly in the middle. Centrist is the insult of the week online, it would seem. But he is a centrist, I think. He's an intelligent soul, and I think rather wise. And he says, you know, I rarely vote because I really rarely feel that anybody, he's a couple of years younger than me, I really feel that anybody, he feels that politicians, and this I think goes back to what you were saying earlier, think in the short term. And, you know, I think for party
and their own survival comes first.
And the dogma of their party as well and what they should say. I mean, the whip, for example, and whip politics and that sort of thing. And he said, I would vote for someone that had the foresight to try and think about the direction of travel in which the country is going and aim to alter it for the next 30 or 40 years. And he said, for me, the only politician that I feel I was ever able to vote for in my lifetime that had that vision was Tony Blair. And I thought that was an interesting point. So I know I've wandered a bit off topic here, but I think that, you know, this is one of a number of problems, I think, with society that is increasingly, and I think this fits in with the fragile masculinity, and I bet lots of them voted for Brexit, you know, with the when England lost to Iceland, there was lots of chance of we all voted out, wasn't there? And you know, part of me thinks that actually it goes back to this idea of trying to grasp a past that was never there. And also, and I think there are interesting parallels in, like we say, the Labour Party and some of the sort of hard left's fury with what they perceive to be evil centrists at the moment. Because I think deep down, Brexiters and them are the same, and these kind of football fans raging against, you know, newfangled things like gay people, lol, and all that sort of thing. I think they know deep down that they're onto a loser. And again, we look at Charlottesville and all that kind of stuff as well. All of these people that rage against minorities, I think, know that deep down that they are the minority and that they're not going to win ultimately. And I think this is a raging against the dying of the light in many cases. But also there are legitimate concerns about, you know, where is our future going for a lot of people? You know, society seems to be getting more unequal rather than less. So you know, I don't think it's right that people shoot footballers, and I don't think it's at all right that people, you know, lob abuse at footballers and sports people generally, you know, and are unpleasant. But ultimately, I have a little bit of sympathy with the anger that lives there, and I can kind of see why that manifests itself here in the way that it does, really.
Mm. Well, now, it's broadly 40 years since punk and roughly 20 years since the rise of Britpop.
Yes.
Have either got the staying power to be classed as landmarks in our musical heritage. Mm. We're all over that after this soul classic from the Cornelius Brothers and Sister Rose.
Everywhere, as she told me, it can break your heart out and put you in misery. Since I met this little woman, I feel it's happened to me, and I'm telling you, it's too late to turn back now. I believe I'm falling in love. It's too late. I believe I'm falling in love. I found myself phoning her at least 10 times a day. You know, it's so unusual for me to carry on this way. I tell you, I can't sleep at night. That this feeling just can't be right. And I'm telling ya, it's too late to turn back now. I believe I'm falling in love. It's too late to turn back now. I believe I'm falling in love.
A radio hit in the UK, but it reached number 2 on the Billboard Hot 100 in 1972. One of the great soul singles of all time, in my view, Cornelius Brothers and Sister Rose, It's Too Late to Turn Back Now.
And I agree, actually. And I think we are very good. There are some people that claim they're excellent at spotting hits. Mm. I think we're very good at spotting stuff that should have been hits. So I think we're good at identifying lost hits, really, because that is wonderful. Like you say, I don't understand why that wasn't number one for about 6 weeks in a row, really. I don't get it.
And it's again, one has to pay sort of tribute to Tony Blackburn here, because he was the only person playing that sort of music at that time on national radio, and then a little tiny bit later on local radio on BBC Radio London. And he has passionately espoused the soul music for his entire career. And you know, as I say, if more of his Radio 1 colleagues perhaps had pushed that, then it may have been a hit over here.
Absolutely. And I know we've talked about Tony Blackburn before, and
love
yes,
him to bits.
He is a bit daft at times, but you know, I like listening to Tony Blackburn on the radio. I like the fact that after 40 years he is still almost crashing the vocals. I've always listened to him with my heart in my mouth to some extent, but you know, I just think he's great. And we talked previously about how shabbily he was treated by the BBC. God. I'm glad he's back now. Yes. And actually, I think it says an awful lot about him that he was able to be gracious enough to go back. I think a lot of people would have gone, oh, sod this, myself included, probably. So I think actually he is a great, because unlike all of those quote-unquote personality DJs of the 1970s, he really knew his stuff. He wasn't kind of a Dave Lee Travis that was just sort of there, or you know, not really that interested in the music, like Chris Moyles. I feel Chris Moyles was the Dave Lee Travis of his generation, and there he is now scraping a living on X, which makes me very glad, actually, given how utterly unpleasant Chris Moyles has been to people, and I know personally people who have been on the receiving end. So actually, I really like Tony Blackburn, because even though him and John Peel had a rather unfortunate kind of rivalry, I rather like Tony, actually.
Well,
I think you know, I have a lot of time.
On that, you will have to go a very long way indeed to find anybody who would have a bad word about Tony Blackburn. He's never, ever dissed anybody or been horrible to anybody or been rude to people. He's been pleasant, kind-hearted and caring all through his life. And I have to say, as someone who was actually at the BBC at the time, I don't want to speak badly of people who are no longer with us. However, all that sort of wars between Tony Blackburn and one or two of the kind of late-night prog rock punky DJs was not from Tony Blackburn's side.
No,
he was I have walked along a BBC corridor next to somebody who's seen as a sort of national treasure of BBC radio and but there's a punk and everything, and saw him snub Tony Blackburn, who said good morning, hi to him, and just saw him sort of like completely blank him. So it wasn't quite the way it's been portrayed, I think.
I know. And you know, what can I say? I think Tony Blackburn's fab. So yes, and that's exactly the word that he'd use as well. So I'm pleased about that. And actually, if I was still as good at Tony Blackburn's age, without sounding at all offensive, if I was still that good. If I was as good as he is now, you know, at this age, I'd be delighted. But I think to be as good as he still is, years and years and years into his career, I think that shows real talent.
One thing that the age of music that is sometimes referred to as the punk era proved is that just about everyone has one song in them. I've always believed this, that anybody can write one hit record.
Absolutely. I've written a record that's quite good. You know,
exactly.
It's okay, yeah.
Exactly. I can never think of a time when a music genre or movement created so many groups that had one catchy tune and have attempted a lifelong career from it. One of the great misunderstandings about 1977 is that towns and cities were full to bursting with disillusioned youths creating anarchy on the streets. We tend to forget it was the era of a Labour government. It just wasn't so. Many of the blokes in punk bands, by the way, had until 3 months earlier all been playing country rock in pubs in London. They all had shoulder length hair. Then suddenly they all shaved off the hair, and in many cases shaved 5 or 10 years off their ages as well. And also, there was no punk movement. Even, I was deeply involved at the time. And I and many others, despite our involvement in punk rock, you would go into a record shop on a Saturday, and as well as buying the new single by the Ramones, I might buy a Donna Summer single or Fleetwood Mac album at the same time. So punks didn't exist as a genre beyond a few youngsters posing in the King's Road. And a huge amount of so-called punk music is unlistenable 40 years later. People are still playing Fleetwood Mac's Rumours from 1977. Mm. Nobody plays the Sex Pistols album. So punk doesn't bear scrutiny. And so, Jules, I'm asking you, will Britpop be remembered more fondly?
Well, and actually, I think there are really, really interesting parallels here in the punk, you had a few groups that were genuine big hitters. Mm. And I would include, I know that we've occasionally differed on this, but the Sex Pistols did genuinely have big hits.
Yes, they did.
Maybe they were the Oasis of the punk era, I don't know. But the Sex Pistols, the Clash, obviously.
The Damned.
I'd say the Damned, the Stranglers.
Buzzcocks.
Yeah, and maybe a couple of others. Mm. But and Britpop was similar in that I think for me the definitive book on Britpop, which is excellent and really interesting, is The Last Party by John Harris, who's a great writer anyway. And I met him once and he was very lovely. And his theory in this book, and I had a spirited row about this with my friends in a pub fairly recently. Drink had been taken, I regret to say. But John Harris's thesis is that there are only five Britpop bands who have stood the test of time whose work was really worth bothering with. And that was Oasis, Blur, Pulp, Suede and Elastica. They all produced work that stands up now. Nobody else really has. The sixth, the kind of unofficial member, which we had a big argument about whether or not they were Premier League Britpop, was Supergrass. And everyone said, oh, but everyone knows All Right. And it's like, yeah, that's one song. You know, I think Supergrass are great. And so actually it was interesting. I think I'd spoken previously on the podcast about this when I went to see Sleeper and My Life Story recently with a friend of mine. Mm. They were Britpop bands. My Life Story had a smattering of kind of top 40, top 50 hits. And Sleeper had a few singles. And Sleeper's stuff held up pretty well, I thought. I was quite surprised because lyrically it was very interesting. Mm. And My Life Story stuff, halfway through, my friend turned to me and said, this could literally be anyone from 1996, couldn't it, really? It was very much that kind of bouncy sound in the way that punk is very much about driving guitars and shouting. And much of Britpop became about bouncy sort of bass lines and ba-ba-ba trumpets and kind of, hey, cheeky cockney type vocals and you know, booming drums. And it was all very Menswear being the kind of nadir of this, in my view. And they were literally Blur fans that decided to form a band and chance how far they could get. And so I think there are similarities between the two in that, you know, you passed off this kind of, it was very much of its time, if you see what I mean. I suppose as well, my other thought about Britpop and punk being similar is that there were an awful lot of one-hit wonders or two-hit wonders.
Yeah, that's what I was saying about how everybody's got one song in them, yeah.
Absolutely, and it was a sort of a genre. And actually, interestingly, you say about sort of punk and people still singing sort of Fleetwood Mac and things like that. It was very interesting that people think of a certain point of the 70s being all about punk. Mm. People often, you know, define the late 70s about being about punk when it wasn't. There was still a lot of disco and funk going on. Then it became about ska and post-punk, which was musically far more interesting. And the parallels here, I think, with Britpop are in the middle of the 90s. People think, you know, the 90s was rave and then Britpop, and that's what it was, and then Coldplay and Travis at the end. And actually, there was the trip-hop scene going on in Bristol with some really interesting stuff like Massive Attack and Tricky and Goldie and the drum and Portishead and the drum and bass and that sort of thing. And also you had, you know, one of the biggest selling records of the era was OK Computer by Radiohead, which is not defined as Britpop. And I know we've had previous form on Radiohead in this podcast, but you know.
But I've learnt my lesson.
Well, I don't want to phrase it like that because I don't think it's very nice. Or, you know, you're perfectly entitled to your view. But I think that even if you're not particularly keen on Radiohead, OK Computer sold an absolute shed load and it has really enabled Radiohead to continue their career now. I mean, it's the OK Computer and the Ben stuff that is embraced the most. And actually, that wasn't Britpop at all, really. You had PJ Harvey continuing to forge a successful career. Interestingly, there was this Britpop Now programme, this one-off special that I think is watchable on YouTube. And she appears on that, which is completely incongruous, considering she's in them. Yet somehow she was sort of allowed on, really, because she was successful. So there were, and again, I know I have form on PJ Harvey, but there were lots of interesting, Bjork forging a successful career during the 90s. There are lots of interesting things going on, which in a way, as much as I loved Britpop, and I will always be fond of Britpop, and I do quite like listening to Shine compilations in the Swiss, I suspect the same way you probably quite like listening to the 70s compilations, but you know, there was it was a fad, wasn't it? Really, it was a scene. It was a T-shirt. It was it was mine was a Union Jack T-shirt. Yours was a T-shirt with a hole in it and a safety pin. You know, it was still a T-shirt, wasn't it? Ultimately, and I have to kind of admit that in a way, I liked Britpop because I liked the style of music. So even though it is very much guitar, kinksy type stuff by Numbers, I do happen to like that. So, but having said that, you can like something whilst realising that it isn't exactly earth-shattering. It meant a lot to quite a few people who were perhaps at university in that era, although I have to be honest and say, and I include myself in this, meant an awful lot to middle-class white kids. Mm. Not everybody is a middle-class white kid, which is why when occasionally I do a U and think, what is this grime? Who is this Skepta? I think, actually, do you know what? I'm not a kid on a council estate in South London. You know, this is not meant for me, and it's perfectly fine for things to not be meant for me. So actually, you know, in a way, and that's why I love Six Music, but I can see the downside to Six Music and Glastonbury and all that kind of stuff, because it is all very much white people who have done very well out of this, thank you very much, who were students in the early 90s. I'm not begrudging anyone else's success. I don't want to fall down that path. But,
you're spot on with that observation.
Yeah, absolutely. People, you know, who were at university before there were loans, before there were, you know, when there were still grants, before there were tuition fees or loans you had to pay back, who therefore were able to afford houses in parts of London at fairly economic prices in the early 90s. And I think punk is the same, actually. I think there are parallels here. People that were squatting and then bought nice little houses for nothing in Notting Hill that are now worth millions.
Very much.
And you know, your butter flogging merchant, Mr. Rotten, for example, professional reality contestant. And I don't care if he hears this.
He bought a house just off the Fulham Road, about 200 yards from Chelsea's football ground, with the first sort of money that came in. Yeah. And, you know, had he held on to that, I drove past it every time.
Mm. It's worth a fortune.
It would be worth three, four million.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And so I do feel a little bit embarrassed now by my sort of Britpop nostalgia. When you see the kind of people who are, you know, are in very comfortable jobs in their late 40s, kind of, you know, continuing to live this Britpop. You know, I did the same. I went and saw Sleeper and really enjoyed it and sung along and remembered my teenage years. But I also remembered how fortunate I am now, really. And I think this is where, you know, punk and Britpop were of their time. They were youth cultures of their time. I'm glad that now there are things like grime up and coming that have replaced us and made us less relevant. You know, I'm not as old as some of my fed up Britpop fans, but, you know, why the hell should the music that I liked when I was 17 or 18 still be relevant to 17 or 18 year olds now? I'm not meant to stay relevant. We're meant to get irrelevant so that then, you know, people can find, new generations can find their own relevancy. So actually, I think in a way, the rehabilitation of punk and Britpop makes me a bit uncomfortable, really, because it's like, well, do you know what? We've had our fun. I think it's time for someone else to have their fun, really.
I have a bit of a yin and yang thing with Britpop. I think the link between the Cheshire Cat grin of Tony Blair and Cool Britannia, you know, that still jars to me in retrospect.
Yeah, and actually, but this is where this book is really interesting, in that John Harris's book, because he is a writer on politics as well and sort of Labour sympathetic, he does draw a lot of comparisons between the two and the general mood of Cool Britannia. Although, having said that, I think there are quite a lot of us in the centre at the moment in a Brexity type world with no leadership. We might pine for that a little bit.
But I just feel we were betrayed from the potential of a new dawn to a sort of narcissistic nightmare where we were suddenly bombing civilians in Iraq.
Yeah, that
wasn't
true.
That wasn't the idea. That felt a long journey from Noel Gallagher having a glass of wine in Downing Street.
Right. Although, having said that, though, you know, again, we can rehash the whole Blair arguments of the cow come home. And again, I think this feeds into that same thing. I'm very sorry that a lot of middle class white musicians were peed off by the fact we bombed Iraq. You know, I was peed off at the time. Having said that, you know, what would have happened if we didn't? And that murderous dictator stayed in place. And in the meantime, national minimum wage, you know, thousands more police officers and nurses and things. And I think
sure
I am
start,
starting to. Yes, exactly. Yeah. You know, we can all reel them off, can't we, if we want to? That's the thing. If we want to, we can. So my view is kind of a bit, yes, you know, Britpop is a bit tainted by Cool Britannia. But having said that, it was in many ways, it was a genuinely exciting cultural time, perhaps. And, you know, I have made my own points about the class dimension to it, but so, and again, punk I suppose, you know, there were, and actually the thing about, the thing I find more interesting actually is post-punk and particularly ska. And I mean, Ghost Town is one of my favourite ever records, not just because of what it is, but because of what it meant and how it's beautifully reflected what was going on when it was number one for 4 weeks in 1980 during the Brixton riots. So I do think that one interesting aspect of punk and Britpop is that to some extent they reflected, punk reflected the anger of the time and Britpop reflected the hope of the time. So maybe, I don't know, maybe there'll be a punk revival before there'll be a Britpop revival. I don't know.
Well, I think, Britpop has a greater legacy than an era that existed as a money-making scheme for Malcolm McLaren. I'm far more, it's far more listenable as well.
Absolutely. There are tunes. You know, they may not be dateable, but there are tunes.
Jules, where might we engage with you in the coming week if we desire to do so?
I'm having a weekend of going to social things, both with work colleagues and family colleagues, so make of that what you will. But I will be adopting similar poses at both, I suspect, of smiling gladly with a glass in my hand. But I will be doing Indie Wonderland, I hope, if I can fit to my computer in time, next Wednesday, 8 until 10 p.m, barracuderadio.com, tunes, basically, indie, alt-rock, miscellaneous tunes, and much of me burbling on like this as well.
Massive thanks to our exhilarating executive producer, Rona.
She is her excellency, yes.
To play us out, a man who, my extensive research reveals, has released over 80 albums and has 3 Grammys.
Yes, he has lived quite a life. He is my joint favourite jazz pianist. I know that's a hotly contested, much desired title, with Oscar Peterson as well, who also has released a load of albums, 10 in 1 year in 1958,
good
I think.
Grief.
Absolutely. I know that you dislike instrumentals passionately, and I don't always pick them deliberately to troll you. On this occasion, I haven't, actually. I feel that jazz is a better class of instrumental. I can understand why you find that, you and indeed many of our regular listeners, as they often say, by many of my,
you'll probably be get told again, yes.
Yeah, well, no, but I'm saying don't, guys, because this isn't some chintzy nonsense. I'm going to get told off for calling Spanish flea chintzy nonsense. But stuff like the limoncello thing, for example, which someone said was the worst record they'd ever heard. Jazz, I think, is a slightly different thing, and that jazz is at least meant to be instrumental. You know, that's the point of jazz, isn't it, by and large? And I've got very into listening to Ramsey Lewis again recently, because I love jazz piano and jazz piano trios and that sort of thing. And I found a sort of an album of his which had lots of 60s type covers on it, which were actually very good and very interesting. A few Beatles numbers, an excellent version of Hang On Sloopy with lots of people singing along, and his is called Hanging On Sloopy. Also 1-2-3 by Len Barry, an excellent version of that. But I've picked this because I do think it's particularly good, and I can't quite resist having a bit of a dance to it. So hopefully, if you can be persuaded to dance, you can be distracted from the fact that it's an instrumental. These are the Ramsey Lewis Trio, and this is them having a go at Stevie Wonder's Uptight, brackets, Everything's All Right, close brackets.
You have been listening to a DACM Media production.